Part 5. Curach. Chapter 15. Queen Anir took her ease in a throne of spines. Her expression was tranquil, eyelids heavy, skeletal features slack. Her chambers were sparse, cleared even of the petty oddments that had elevated Lurien's quarters from the status of mere cave, and infused with the seed scent of the Enovas. The sword and spear-armed Asclear that flanked her throne wore the limp white poppies on their armour as tokens of favour. Anir herself had one threaded through her crown by the stem. The seed scent was said to induce a transcendental state of serenity that cared not for the trappings or woes of the mortal world. That accounted for her expression, but not the throne. Lurien had been surprised to see that she had transported it all the way to Gwethyn for the wedding. But then even puritanical tyrants were entitled to their hubris. Lurien was hardly immune. He was Idoneth. It was the great failing of the species. His equivalent sin was to accuse her of ambivalence when he was not at all sure that he cared about their imminent defeat himself. Whether it was the potency of the Enovas in the water, or recent reversals, he was wearing a barrier layer between himself and the world, a blubber of numbness. Namariel had been right, and the admission of that was like a filleting spear through his belly. He had thought of this as a game. He had believed that with the barest minimum of effort, the jade crown would just float onto his brow. Now elves were dead. Eadren at least had the consolation of the limbic eternity of the Gwethyn Corileum alongside Galrahir's ancestors, which was more than Ureel or Moragai could look forward to. And as for Nael, he sucked in his cheeks and stared up at the throne. He was trying not to think about Nael. "Are you even listening?" he muttered.
"I am listening."
Anir stirred herself to direct her poppy, hollow frown towards Galrahir and Mabor. Gwyndir and Namariel, though both had insisted, had been denied at the door by Anir's guard. It had been the one blessing that Lurien could cling to.
"To all of you."
Mabor, still garbed in his wedding finery and indigo-flushed from too much colep and dancing, bowed in acknowledgement. Galrahir merely grunted, a mute observance of the niceties.
"And yet you have nothing to say," said Lurien. "Because were I in your position, I would at the very least be amused by my plight. I might even gloat, say that I had seen this coming all along, and had warned my witch of a mother of it the day she adopted me as her heir."
Anir's placid gaze settled over Lurien.
"Did you murder Prince Nael?"
"No."
Lurien spat the answer, as though absolvement from Namariel's actions were the best he could pray for now.
"Or solicit the Namatai assassin that Larame has taken to perform the deed on your behalf?"
"No."
"Why should I believe you?"
"If I knew the answer to that question, you would not need to ask it."
Anir eased back into her hard throne.
"Believe it or not, I do believe you. I think that if you had done this thing and had been found out, then you would not be so chastened by it now. You are thoughtless and arrogant, but what I see grovelling before me now is not a murderer. He is an elf of poor self-restraint, one whose soul has been tormented and is relieved at having its sins exposed."
Lurien's lips twitched.
He dipped his head to the throne.
"Thank you, Queen Anir."
"Do not thank me. What Larame Farsia does or does not believe about the death of her heir is inconsequential to me."
"But it says something about me, don't you think?"
"It says you are not a fratricidal opportunist, which is frankly the very least one could look for in a king. That you were able to talk Nael into raiding Coriza also says something about you, and I'm not sure that it is good. I am the Queen of Turak, and it is Turak I look to. I do not care who reigns in Briomda.
And yet you conspired with Vanglire.
Anir's eyes glittered behind their Enovas glaze.
Conspired? Hardly. I simply refused to take a stand on principle then, as I refuse to take one now.
Lurien sighed, unable to muster the conviction to argue further.
Marbor supped thoughtfully on the Corlep flute he had brought with him when summoned from the after-ceremony for Lurien and Gwyndir at the sanctuary, but said nothing. Galrahir scowled at all three of them.
"Then Glyad Felglif and Laname Farsir are coming now," he said, dropping his voice to a rough-edged growl that could soar through ice. "They are coming here."
"The currents will be against them," said Marbor.
"Unless they take a more circuitous route," Lurien mumbled, "as I did."
"They strike directly from the Pearl City," said Galrahir. "My own tide casters push back, but they are no match for Laramie. Even the untrained acolytes of the Solskrae of Fame have begun to feel her wake."
"How many?" asked Lurien.
"Briomda has the largest army in the Green Gulch," said Galrahir. "Vanglaya can field 20,000 warriors, and Laramie perhaps another 1,000. Were I in the Felglaive's boots, I would be looking to demonstrate my strength."
He glanced at Anir.
"I would also not be sure where the might of Turak lay. I would be bringing every sword I could muster."
He tore his gaze away and growled.
"My Isharan concur."
"But Gwerthyn is famed for its martial prowess," said Lurien. "Your enclave is a fortress, and you said yourself that Vanglaya was inexperienced in true war. Could Gwethyn and Dwyhor alone defeat him here?"
"It's still that number is 3-1, and the true might of Briamdar and Elgain isn't the number of their swords, but their Isharan. I haven't the number sword practitioners of sufficient skill to overcome them. I told you that my tidecasters are already feeling the strain of resisting their approach. Why, Laramie alone could break open the roof of this enclave and bury us all inside."
Lurien nodded in agreement. He could attest to his aunt's might. Galrahir glared at him.
"She's angry enough."
Both elves turned to Marbor. He smiled back at them, like an evil moon rising.
"The Isharan of Dwyhor are supposed to be powerful," said Galrahir. "Tested in battle. Enough to rival Laramie?"
The Laughing King played with the tapered end of his chin.
"Time will tell."
Galrahir flung his hand above his head.
"We need Turak."
"I see that," said Anir. "The Heralclea we left scattered at the young prince's wedding can see that. But it is aid I have no obligation or interest in providing. This council of panic does not endear me to your cause."
"Do you think I'll just allow you to leave this chamber without your support?"
said Galrahir. The two Asclean knights either side of Anir's throne subtly tilted their heels, so that a single kick would be enough to interpose them between the three kings and their queen, should the need arise. Anir, however, gave no reaction.
"And you will prevent me? How? Will you kill me, Galrahir?"
The huge Archelian shrank before her vacant stare. His head slumped.
"No."
"No,"
Anir repeated.
"We are Idoneth. Our lives are too precious to end on a whim."
She looked at Lurien as she said it, though whether she was referring to the death of Prince Nael or the killing of the Archelian in his bedchamber, he was not sure. Then again it occurred to him that she might equally have been referring to Vanglaire's decision to spare his life in the first place.
"I can hold you hostage," said Galrahir.
until Van Glyre and Laramie arrive, she agreed. But holding me under guard in these chambers will hardly improve your chances in the coming battle.
Well, Dewey Hoare stands with you to the bitterest of ends, Lurian, said Marbore.
Discarding his corlip flute, the laughing king rolled back the sleeve of his kelp-green livery to bare the lean, russet-coloured muscle of his forearm, and the oath rune that his Ishratizar had tattooed there.
It has been declared before Mathlan and all the gods beneath him, toasted with corlip, and can be broken only in blood. You returned the souls of my forebears to the keeping of an Achaelian king, and so my life is yours.
He drew his sleeve back down, covering his arm.
If it is the judgment of those here that Gwethyn cannot stand, then you must return with me to Dewey Hoare. Yes. We will make our stand with the dirge of the forest in our blades and the sun's light on our backs and see how well our enemy fares before the wild beasts and spites of the deep wood.
He's going nowhere,
Galrahir made an angry gesture,
and neither are you. He's wedded to my daughter, part of my house. I thought we had Laramie on our side.
He shook his head like a monster in a cage.
I've gone too far to make this right with Van Glyre now.
Well, then come with us.
Marbor extended a hand to his red gauntleted counterpart. Galrahir looked at it as though the fingers were poisonous.
You, Sylvia, your daughter, your warriors.
He bared dark green teeth in a grin, but there was madness in it, madness and pain.
There is room for them aplenty in Dewey Hoare.
You would like to see me so diminished, said Galrahir. Truly, your mind is restored, you conniving Fwaithain.
The laughing king gave him a painted-on grin.
If this is it,
said Galrahir, glancing between Lurien and Marbor,
if this is all we can come up with together, then I have no choice.
He turned his back on the laughing king, straightening to his full height as his expression hardened.
I will hold you and Gwyndir until the Felglaive arrives, and then I'll surrender you both and pray he's in the mood for forgiveness.
You would give up your own daughter, said Marbor.
I have more of them.
Lurien found he was too numb to care any more. Eadren, Ureil, Nael, all dead now because of him.
When did it end?
Namariel, too, had enthroned Morrigai, an ally and a confidant, to a far worse fate for far lesser cause. She'd wanted to make a point. All Galrahir was doing was protecting his enclave. And was it not even a little true when it came down to it, when the gods settled on their judgments, that on some implicit level he had been a party to his cousin's eternal suffering as a plaything of the Chaos Gods? He had certainly benefited from Namariel's treachery, and had continued to act the part she had made for him even after he had come to suspect the truth. One elf's callousness was another's cold calculation. Raging against where that finest of lines should lie was like fighting the tide with a blade of seagrass. He sighed, shrugged. Anir leant forward in her throne.
You seem remarkably sanguine about your fate, Lurien. I did not think you had such tranquillity in your soul.
Lurien shook his head. It must be the Enavas. The queen glanced to the warrior on her left. A white poppy threaded through the rings of his mail and idly brushed the limp flower in her crown, as though only then reminded there was something there.
No. I do not think so. I think your time in exile has finally taught you something of value. Perhaps the gods have not wholly abandoned you yet.
They have their usual curious way of showing it.
They don't show it at all, Galrahir muttered. They are our gods, after all.
Anir rested the point of her chin on the backs of her hands, studying Lurien with glassy-eyed intensity, as though wavering on the edge of a thought.
"It is not for me to care who rules in Briamdar, but I know what Galra here says is true. The Felglave will not content himself with Briamdar."
"Then you'll fight with us?"
said Galrahir. Anir sat back into her throne of spines, her hands tracing the wicked curve of the rests. Her smile was a drowned and trebly damned thing.
"If Prince Lurien is able to do something for me in exchange."
The glove was chainmail to the elbow and shagreen up to the bicep, weighted over the knuckles with lead plates and spiked along the back of the fist like one half of a mace. Lurien shook the mail down over his fingers, then made a fist and smacked it across Venom's snout. The backhand tore grey flesh from the slumbering beast's jaw, but failed to rouse her.
"Wake up, you overgrown tadpole!"
he struck her again.
"If we don't leave Gwethyn now, we may as well stay here and wait for Vanglire."
Bound beasts slept deeply and often. With so little of their minds left after the embalers were finished, there was precious little going on behind those scarred eyes to occupy them if left too long unattended. The best-trained creatures would lie unmoving until they starved, unless specifically commanded to feed. Venom was a Turach beast. She was amongst the best-trained creatures.
"Up!"
he thumped her in the ear. This time she stirred, raising her sledge-like head and tasting the water with a flick of her tongue. Lurien felt his ears pop, his extremities tingling as the Fangmora's vault sacs began to emit charge. He took her jaw with the gauntlet, his hand roughly the size of one of her teeth, and turned her head towards him, allowing her flickering tongue to catch the taste of her master.
"That's right. It's Lurien, Prince of the Deep Nothing and Laughing Stock of the Gods. We've met before."
A snarl emanated through the netting of the neighbouring stall, where Felenduil was having a similar struggle rousing Eodren's Fangmora. The Elgonite beast was less completely broken and had awoken easily enough, but the Isharan was not its master. It was only because there was some familiarity to the tired caster's taste that the Fangmora had not already bitten off his arm. The old elf was wheezing already, the gauntlet heavy in the water from a dozen unrewarded blows to the jaw.
"Hit it again,"
Lurien suggested, hanging his own gauntlet from the hook on the roof of his net.
"I could hit it until Teclis recants his hubris and welcomes his lost children back to Leriu. It will make no difference."
Lurien threw the heavy silver-blue caparison over Venom's back, then the saddle, manually tightening the cinches that would bolt it to the Fangmora's oily hide.
"My gauntlet will yield before this beast does,"
Felenduil complained.
"Perhaps the Tynecaster should stick with the Teglai," Namariel suggested.
She floated just outside the beast's globular enclosures. The Namatai was again dressed for the rigours of open water, in a ribbed linen kirtle, buttoned and weighted, a sturdy cloak over one shoulder. Her tough shagreen bodice was crisscrossed with netting and pouches, and a bulging knapsack hung over the opposite shoulder to her cloak. Her feet were booted and finned. Her whisperwood short bow was unstrung and held in her hands like a journeyman's stave. This was it. The rest of Lurien's phalanx were presently guests of Gwethyn. Or hostages of Galra here, if one preferred the actual language passed down to the Idoneth by the Awakened over that of courtly politics.
"Move back from the nets," Lurien told Namariel. "Your Namatai soul is upsetting the Fangmoras."
Namariel offered an exaggerated bow, then kicked herself backwards, playing out the chain, leaving the outcast to stare blankly through the diamond pattern of the net alone.
"We don't have the time to bring the snail anyway,"
Lurien went on.
"Teglai are perfect for carrying heavy burdens over great distances, but we're in haste."
Felenduil grunted into another solid blow. His gauntlet this time crunched into the Fangmora's eyes socket. It growled, but refused to shift.
I'm told that Van Glare forces a march against the currents and against all the efforts of Gwethyn's Tidecaster Fane.
He kicked the truculent beast in spite, only serving to propel himself slowly back. The net bulged around his body as he pulled off his gauntlet and wheezed.
Even with the full might of Bremjar and Elgaean's Isharan behind them, it will take weeks for the Felglaive to reach Gwethyn.
Lurien wondered at how easily the old elf could speak of the Tidecasters of Elgaean, as though he were not one of them. What horror Namariel had threatened him with to remain at their side when it was surely within his power to flee as Queen Laramée had, Lurien could only imagine. Marbor's restorative berries helped to endear him, no doubt, but Lurien suspected it was their shared experience of Coryza that explained it best. There was a time, not so very long ago, when Lurien would have assumed it was devotion to his leadership that made the Tidecaster remain. How he could scoff at such arrogance now. Truly, had he been Lagithe's son and heir. Loyalty was a fluid concept amongst the Eidoneth. To themselves and to the species they were steadfast, but every layer of hierarchy in between was there to shift with the tides. With the loss of Uriel and Moragai, and the turning of Queen Laramée, Lurien had half expected his slim force to disintegrate around him. That the Tidecaster and the Elgonite Namartai, who had been at the heart of his efforts since the raid on the Alfrostuns, had instead opted to stand by him, was the one glimmer of hope he had in this abyssal time. He did not question it any more. He was just grateful. Weeks in which we are to venture into uncharted ocean far to the west of Turak, Lurien reminded the Tidecaster. Beyond the current streams of the Lathway and the Kelegaeta, beyond the boundaries of the Green Gulch itself, we go into the deep nothing to find a beast the likes of which the Umbelas of Turak have never seen, and return with it as an offering to Queen Anir. So forgive me, Tidecaster. He turned the screws on Venom's harness finger tight. She spasmed in a pain that her body felt, but which the broken wiring of her brain could not understand. She opened her mouth as though expecting food. He slapped it with his bare hand, then returned to Felenduil. We are indeed in some haste. Leaving Venom to sort through her broken nervous system's conflicted signals, he swam around to the entrance flap to Felenduil's enclosure. Once inside, he snatched the Tidecaster's gauntlet from him and slid his arm inside it. Let me show you how it's done, and maybe I won't need to do it for you every tide from here until we lose ourselves to the deep nothing, or find ourselves devoured by some ancient terror.
Not all band beasts respond to pain.
Lurien turned. The Imbala woman he had seen outside the sanctuary of Mathlan before his wedding was swimming to join Namariel at the net. From afar, the elf had appeared elegant, if patrician, much in the manner of the denizens of Turak. Their home was the city of Spines, and it was so called not only for the ancient Leviathan in whose bones the Ironrak had built their first enclave in the Green Gulch. Up close, she was a horror of hard, dead eyes and Druhiri punishment brands, clad in tatty chagrins, sargassum overalls and the pungent musk of beast. Her face would have been nightmarish enough as a mask. As something attached to living bone, it was a death scream in the eye of the beholder. That she somehow contrived to make that potpourri of ruined skin look arrogant made it all the worse. She wore a necklace of what looked like eyeballs. A thick length of rope was wound around one shoulder. An ugly bone cudgel, almost of a length to be considered a quarterstaff, floated from her hip in a thong.
"Not all bound beasts respond to pain," she said again.
Irimée, Lurien remembered. Her name was Irimée.
"Pain is how they are broken," said Irimée. "But afterwards, their minds are broken down and rebuilt, a cycle of provocation and punishment designed to strip away every residual trace of defiance. The broken beast will associate pain with obedience, hunger with obedience, a threat with obedience.
It is a harsh process dependent entirely on the willpower of the embaler for it to be seen properly through.
She smiled as though remembering some old lesson, and something in the look in her eye made Lurian shudder. The embaler peered through the gaps in the net.
Cleft jaw, bleached coloration, about 13 feet long. And see the dual row of spines? Slightly off-centre and asymmetrical, longer on the left side. Characteristic of the Maraglir.
She turned her flat black gaze back to Lurian.
A Fangmore breed native to the oyster reefs of Elgain, and broken by that enclave's own embalers, most likely.
She shook her head, and Lurian flinched, almost expecting a blow from Irime's club in punishment for her disappointment.
Their lack of skill is explicable, if not excusable. Their waters are almost as barren of life as those of Gwethyn. Have you tried a more positive inducement?
It's always answered the rod perfectly well before now, said Leonian.
And then perhaps it needs a firmer hand.
Irime swam into the enclosure. The Elgonite Fangmora was of a smaller breed than the limited number of war beasts kept by the Red Knights of Gwethyn, but the addition of a third elf in the enclosure nevertheless made the 13-foot-long predator feel uncomfortably close. The Fangmora opened its jaws in a universally understood gesture of menace as Irime drew her bone cudgel. At first glance, it looked flawed and lumpen. On second glance, it became clear that it had been assembled from the vertebrae of giant beasts, each one inscribed with black runes that looked like bodies broken on a wheel. A brief glance was enough to make Lurian's skin wish to shed its own nerves. It was Druhiri, black cousin to Eltharai, a forbidden language of the elder days, known only to embalers and those dread few whose sole purpose was the affliction of pain upon others. The embaler tilted the Fangmora's head with the staff, shutting its jaws. Something in her manner, or some innate beast magic in her being, drawing instant obedience from the monster. She uttered a splintered consonant and then drove the rod into the Fangmora's neck. Red light flared from the monster's mouth, a volcanic glare fissuring through the scarified tissue, covering its eyes. Its body stiffened in an instant of agony before its tail lashed into the net behind it. Lurian and Filenduil both ducked, covering their heads with their arms, but it made no attempt to strike them again. It had been a reflex act of the body, an unconscious mechanism unrelated to any free act of will, for the beast possessed none. The blow rippled through the net walls as the Fangmora's pain spasms grew increasingly listless.
"Your mount is awake now, Tightcaster," said Irime.
Lurian dipped his head. "You have my gratitude, Embela."
"Yours is a particularly fine breed,"
Irime went on, gesturing through the nets, while Eodrain's former mount nuzzled the back of her hand and licked the scarred, bitten flesh of her arm. "She is," said Lurian.
"One day you will have to tell me how you came by an Asclear beast."
"One day?"
"I am told you are bound for the deep nothing, west even of Tudak."
"And I thought the Gwethyn knew nothing of gossip. It seems they need no lessons in that from the Briamdane."
"If you mean to take a beast, then you will have need of an embaler. You will need me."
"I don't need to break the beast, merely capture and return it." Irime's face twisted into a sneer.
3 pairs of hands, counting your own, to bring in a beast supposedly greater than a Leviodon."
"You've seen it?"
"With my own eyes, no, no one has. But it is a soul shadow that embalers who venture out that way have sensed. Some have gone to seek it, but none have returned. And Anir has since forbidden any true-souled elf of Turak from attempting to claim it again."
Lurian understood now why the queen had thought to send him. She would either win the beast her enclave had desired for many years, or she would be rid of Prince Lurian.
He could not fault her reasoning.
Two old students of mine, Flawain and Valhanir, were amongst the last to go in search of the monster's lair.
So this is about revenge? Irime's thin mouth tightened until it almost resembled a smile, bubbles issuing from the narrowest of cracks in the corners. Lurien had the horrible impression that she was laughing.
Hardly. Flawain was gifted but soft-hearted. Valhanir was the same. My interest in them expired when they chose to leave my charge.
So why would you want to help me? Said Lurien.
Why do you care?
Care is a strong word, but I have a suspicious mind these days.
My reasons are my own, but the satisfaction of breaking such a behemoth of the unknown would be reason enough for most to dare the wrath of the queen. The glory of the deed should we succeed. The desire for fame was what always drove Ubreich, my master, and Gilean, who was his master. Of course, my deeds have already eclipsed them both. They were weak, too, in their own ways. Did you know that I was the Embalo who broke the deep mare that Anir herself rides in battle? But there is always more to achieve, higher to reach, before my name is remembered alongside Moru in the first of the Embalos.
Her smile, if that was what it had been, faded.
Regardless, you need me. The breaking of a beast is only the final application of an Embalo's talents. Tracking, trapping, binding. These are all skills of which the Embalo is master.
She turned to Felenduel.
The Felglaive is mere weeks away. Oh, did I hear that incorrectly, Tidecaster?
The old Elgonite glanced at Lurien, as if for permission, then gave the Embalo a tired nod.
You need me,
Irime said again. Lurien frowned. He was unaccustomed to altruistic offers of assistance. And you want nothing in return?
Only the chance to be there.
Lurien shared a glance with Felenduel and Namariel, then shrugged. Fine. You carry your own gear, bring your own mount if you have one, and we leave in an hour. Don't expect anyone here to wait for you.